prepare yourselves for Ethan and Aaron's Confessions of a Movie Snob, the ongoing discussion of film genres.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Aaron. With me, as always, is Ethan.
Yo.
Yo, 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 Ethan. Tonight we're going to have back a show favorite, one of my favorite guests we've had on, Mr. Christopher McLaughlin.
Otherwise known as McG.
McG.
But not the McG.
Two jerks, like Ethan and myself. How are you today, sir?
I'm just fine, gentlemen. Thank you very much for that introduction. And all my students call me McG, so you're in plenty good company there.
And,
yes.
And I thought I was being funny when I came up with that on my very own.
You're never being funny.
Well, not even that. I'm not even being original. Yeah. But speaking of not being funny, tonight we are actually doing a long time coming show. On the show, we do like to talk about film genres, and tonight we're going to be talking about the film genre of comedy. It's one that, as soon as we started talking about, I knew that we were going to have to do it because everyone talks comedies, but it was one I didn't want to do right out the gate because I do have some things I want to say about it, and I just wanted to make sure we had the format nailed down and we know what we're doing. So I decided that, this is more or less my topic for a change. I mean, we usually have our guests choose it. Tonight, this is one that, you know, I wanted to make sure we did, but I just invited Christopher on because we've had success with him in the past.
And you might remember on last episode, we said we were going to do samurai movies.
Yeah, well, I edited that out. So okay. Now I have to edit this out
again.
You
didn't say that in the last episode. History has been rewritten.
Yeah, time machine. Yes. I actually did edit that out. But it's all right.
You know, you could leave it in there. It could be like, you know, the promised sequel at the end of Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
you know, just let people wonder.
So we could do
the Man of Bronze 2 or
no,
something.
No, Aaron and Ethan versus what was that one versus it was like the Big Boss or the World Crime League or something like that.
Yeah, that'd be excellent.
Yes,
dude, can't, dog, stop it. But before we do that, we do have a segment we like to call Geekly Happenings. It's when we talk about news that's relevant to us geeks. And I actually brought some news this time around, but why don't we let – I don't know. Do you want me to open it up with one, or do you want to open it up, or what?
I don't care.
Why don't you do it, I guess?
All right. First thing on my list is producer Neil Moritz is turning his attention to a reboot of Paul Verhoeven's 1997 Starship Troopers.
Yeah, because it has been so long.
Yes, which was loosely based on the novel by Robert A. Heinlein. Vulture has the news saying that Thor and X-Men First Class screenwriters Ashley Edward Miller and Zach Stenz have come on board to write the script. So we're going to get a new Starship Troopers. We'll see if it's closer to the books this time.
I liked the first one. I mean,
the first one's
fun.
Entertaining, you know, for what it is.
I haven't read the book, so I don't really have anything to comment towards.
I have read the book, and the book is quite good.
Is it?
You know, the really funny thing about all this is, of course, there's going to be the inevitable. Are they going to bring back the original cast for cameos?
Yes.
And in this
Neil
case,
Patrick
we're talking
Harris.
About people that, like, 2 years ago were shooting direct-to-video sequels to this.
Yeah. Casper Van Dien. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now, obviously, Neil Patrick Harris is more in the big time now because people love him. So I love him. He's great.
Yeah. And my girlfriend wants to be his fag hag, apparently.
Yes.
So
hey,
that's
you know,
good.
Whatever works for her. And I'm bringing this one up just because you were talking Watchmen just the other week.
Was I? Oh, yeah. Well, between us. Not
yeah,
really
between
on
us,
the show.
Not on the show.
Okay.
But Andy Kubert apparently is on for a Watchmen prequel comic book. According to Bleeding Cool, Andy Kubert will be drawing one of the four Watchmen prequel miniseries, and, quote, he may not be the only Kubert getting involved with it. As was previously reported, Darwin Cook is creating the overarching storyline for the prequels. Other artists and writers whose names have been linked to the Watchmen prequels include Dave Gibbons, J.G. Jones, JMS, and John Higgins. So,
personally, I'm not interested.
DC has been very tight-lipped about whether or not they're going to do a Watchmen prequel series. I know Alan Moore is, of course, dead set against it, but, I mean, it's Alan Moore. He's
throwing handfuls of
everything.
Poop at him anytime they ask.
Yes, yes.
Pulling lollipops out of his big bushy beard.
Yes. And anyone listening to last week's show know that we went and saw The Muppets.
We did.
And it was awesome. We
yes.
loved it.
Uh-huh.
But I just spotted this story because I thought it was really amusing that Fox News is apparently has decided that the show Follow the Money host Eric Bowling said, yeah. quote, that liberal Hollywood is using class warfare to brainwash our kids with the Muppets.
Huh.
He had one of his experts lumped the Muppets and Cars 2 in the same category as Syriana and There Will Be Blood. I just thought that was amusing because anyone who saw the movie sort of...
Yeah, I've yeah. I did see the Muppets and I saw Syriana and I saw There Will Be Blood. I didn't see any similarities.
Yeah, there's a few differences there. I think the ultimate thing is they're latching on, you know, the villain is Tex Richmond and he's a oil magnate and Texan and blah, blah, blah.
Maniacal laugh.
Like, maniacal laugh, yes.
Maniacal laugh.
Okay, you're trying to, like, put this adult spin on this movie that is so obviously made for kids.
And it's a parody.
Yeah, and exactly. It's like, well... He's the, you know, big corporate businessmen are the villain of our villain right now because, well, they are the villain right now.
And they always will be the villain. So
yeah.
Good old Fox News. Always good for a laugh.
And speaking of lovely capitalism, comic creator Stephen Busty is suing Universal Pictures and Platinum Studios, claiming that they ripped off the concept of his comic story Cowboys and Aliens, which appeared in Bizarre Fantasy No. 1 in 1994. Busty contends that this story provided the basic concept for the 2011 summer blockbuster movie Cowboys and Aliens, which is directed by Jon Favreau.
Now, I have a serious legal question on this.
Okay.
Let's pretend that he does this.
Sure.
Let's pretend he's successful and he wins and gets all kinds of money.
Uh-huh.
What kind of legal precedent would that be setting?
None.
That wouldn't be setting a legal precedent. Basically, he's saying that something versus something belongs to him.
No, he's saying that the concept for the movie, there is more to it.
Okay, it isn't just Cowboys versus Aliens.
He is trying to cite, though, that one of the producers was aware of his idea and then went off and did the movie.
Okay.
So, I mean, there is some...
I thought it was just that he made a movie that had Cowboys and Aliens
fighting. No, he's
fighting.
A comic book.
Or even a... Well, did he even make it? Or was it just a concept?
It was a Cowboys and Aliens type story appeared in a anthology comic that he was part of.
Hmm. Okay,
so
he's looking for shut up and go away money.
Yeah, but the movie actually didn't do too well in theaters, though. I mean,
it doesn't matter. Somebody sued the Wayans brothers, claiming that they ripped off the concept for White Chicks.
Yeah,
if you're willing to stand in front of your fellow man and say no. I originally conceived White Chicks.
So that's something to be proud of.
There's no end to it. There is no end to it.
The thing you have to understand, anyone who's suing someone, is just you're going after people with deep pockets, and this guy thinks he can make a couple bucks from Universal. So it sort of depends if Universal wants to actually fight it or they want to just make him go away.
Weren't they on the verge of declaring bankruptcy this summer?
Probably.
It seems like it. Huh. Okay, well, good luck to him and good luck to Universal, I guess. Why don't we let me jump in right now with one of my news stories.
Sure.
Both of my news stories I have today are kind of quirky, but I thought they were funny. The first one is Capcom has announced a downloadable game for the PC, Xbox Live Arcade, and the PlayStation Network featuring the Sour Patch Kids starring Method Man and Creed Bratton of The Office. To reiterate, this is a real game based on the Sour Patch Kids candy being made by the same people who made Mega Man and Resident Evil, starring a pairing of Method Man and Creed Bratton from The Office. The game is called World Gone Sour. World Gone Sour will be based...
I just want to see it for Creed. He's hysterical.
Yeah, I know. World Gone Sour will be based on a lost piece of candy trying to find its way to candy nirvana via platforming across movie theaters, concession stands, and probably other candy-themed arenas. The game also features the Sour Patch, this guy, and it's showing us a picture of the Sour Patch Kid in tribal paint. And the game will be narrated by Creed Bratton, the lovable office kook, and will sport a Method Man soundtrack for the game's title screen, dubbed World Gone Sour, The Lost Kids.
That's awesome.
The game will feature the accoutrement modes and features games nowadays should have, such as a co-op, global leaderboards, trophies, and achievements. The game is being slated to release during the winter for PC and sometime in 2012 for Xbox Live and the PlayStation Network with the price tag of $4.99. Which, weird, huh? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, that's one of those concepts you go, okay, who came up with this idea while snorting coke off the back of a prostitute?
You know, me, I got $5. I would throw down $5 to check that out at this point. You know, I have a PC, I have the PlayStation Network. It's just something that sounds interesting, especially with the Office angle to it. But weird, huh?
Yeah.
Sorry, I got dogs fighting behind me. But I spotted that, and I thought it was funny. You know, I was thinking about suing, saying I had the idea first, but I don't think I'd get anywhere.
Yeah, probably not.
But, yeah, that's the first piece of news I have. Do you have anything? Yeah, there's plenty more news. What else we got, Ethan?
Well, this came in just before we started recording, but there's a Alfred Hitchcock biopic that's being made. Actually, there's two, but this one is Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho, based on a book by Stephen Rebello. The film's being directed by Sasha Gervasi. Helen Mirren is in talks to play Hitchcock's wife, Alma Reville, and according to this report, Anthony Hopkins has been signed to play Alfred Hitchcock himself. So the film is based on the making set in the late 50s while Hitchcock is making Psycho, obviously. So that sounds interesting. I mean, I love me some Hitchcock, and I love me some Anthony Hopkins. So yeah. Hey, should be interesting.
It should be interesting. Yeah, it was funny when when he was telling me about it earlier. He asked me if I'd heard of a movie. I don't remember, but it was weird because he told me,
like,
he's,
have you heard of Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho?
Yeah, and he said Hopkins, but I heard Alfred Hitchcock, and I'm all like,
yes,
yeah. I've heard of Hitchcock and I've heard of Psycho. Where are we going with this, Ethan? And it was pretty weird. It was really pretty weird. But
yeah, it sounds like an interesting film, but I think I'll wait till Gus Van Sant does the shot-for-shot remake of the making of Psycho.
We were just talking
for that.
About how, since it's the Making of Psycho, you know, they're just going to Vince Vaughn.
Yeah, Vince Vaughn to play Anthony Perkins.
Anthony Perkins.
You have to admit, that would be kind of clever.
No, people hate that. Yeah. I think I'll go vomit. I threw up a little bit in my mouth just then.
Yeah.
I got some brief news, a couple brief news bits. Big one that came out just recently was Patty Jenkins left Thor 2.
Saw that.
Citing creative differences.
Mm-hmm.
Not surprised. They're looking for a new director.
Yeah.
But apparently the split was amicable. They're not
sure.
She's saying she's willing to come do some non-sequel type of thing. So it'd be interesting to see who they pick up for it. I know Branagh can't do it because he's busy.
What's he doing?
I don't know, but I just read an interview with him. It says he's got some acting stuff lined up, and he just wouldn't be able to do it by the time they want the movie out. Some Star Trek news.
Yeah.
Alice Eve has joined the Star Trek sequel. She's the movie she's most known for is She's Out of My League, and it'll be next year in The Raven and Men in Black 3. But more importantly,
who cares about Alice Eve?
Yeah, who cares about that? Because Peter Weller has joined the cast of the next Star Trek movie, and RoboCop himself in a Star Trek movie. I'm there.
Yeah.
Really, it's Peter Weller. I love Peter Weller.
Brother-in-law asked me who I thought he was going to play. I said, I don't care. I hope he's RoboCop.
That would be so awesome.
RoboCop and Star Trek. I mean, I don't particularly care about. I don't care about Star Trek so much to where I need to see a legitimate film made with ongoing continuity. I just want to see RoboCop shooting some Klingons or
But you know who's not joining them?
Who
is Benicio del Toro?
Did he not sign?
He has turned down the Star Trek sequel.
Oh, that's too bad.
He's not going to do it. The rumor has it that he was going to be playing Khan, but which, you know, is still supposition at this point. But
that rumor got killed. J.J. Abrams says he doesn't want to touch Khan.
Yeah, and the rumor is now back. It's kind of ridiculous. We'll see what happens, but he is Benicio del Toro, who was Abrams had said he wanted him to be the villain, has turned the film down. So no Benicio del Toro in the movie.
Oh well, I like Benicio del Toro.
Yep, yep.
He's all right.
There's also Fox is 20th Century Fox is moving forward with a 24 movie.
Off the Keith Sutherland show.
Yeah,
is that show still on?
No, it is. It's been off for about a year and a half, 2 years now.
Huh.
But they're looking at a spring start for it. I know they turned in a first draft of the script, and it was turned down. So, I mean, by the star Kiefer Sutherland, so they're working on it. I was a big fan of the show, so
I never watched. I heard good things about it.
It's a good show, but it's you know it's an acquired taste. You know, Jack Bauer is a badass.
Is he?
So we'll see what happens.
Good to know.
The way the show ended left it very open for more.
Sure.
So. We'll see what happens there.
Was Donald Sutherland ever in it?
No, Donald Sutherland was not in it. Jack Bauer's father showed up, and it was James Cromwell.
Oh, yeah? I like James Cromwell. Yes.
And the show had his things. We're just talking RoboCop. The show seemed to have this whole RoboCop actors thing showing up because several actors who were in RoboCop were in the show at some point or another, including Peter Weller and several of the people who played some of the bad guys in the movie. Including Clarence Boniker. You know, I can never remember Clarence Boniker's name.
The actor?
Kurtwood Smith.
Yeah, Kurtwood Smith. I only see him as Clarence Boniker, which is why that 70s show just was wrong to me.
I don't know. That 70s show was funnier.
I kept
to me
watching
because
that and expecting him to go, "Can you fly, Bobby?" and shoot someone or
blow their arm off.
You know, blow their arms off.
Yeah.
But yeah, like the one guy who gets dunked in the toxic waste and melts.
Yeah.
That guy was in it as Jack Bauer's
that
brother.
That grossed me out when I was a kid.
Yeah. And then the other guy, the pretty boy guy, was in it as a vice president at one point. And
what about Lois?
No, she was not in it.
Damn
but,
it
was kind of
209?
That would have been cool.
That would have been an awesome guest star.
Yeah. Oddly, there are lots of sites for 24 out there, and because the show never really irons out when it is, and between seasons it's like 2 years, you know, a year and a half, 6 months, they figured out that based on events that happen in it and calendars that you can see in backgrounds and stuff like that, the final season was actually like set in 2018.
Excellent.
So, yeah. So it was actually a science fiction show.
Very good. Very good.
The Game of Thrones season 2 comes out next year on HBO and has already reportedly from one of the stars been renewed for a third season already.
Okay, so. Now I understand that the show is good.
Oh yeah, it's good.
Did it get any accolades or is it not to that point yet?
The guy who played Tyrion Lannister won an Emmy.
Oh, what's his name? The little guy.
Yes.
He was in the Station Agent, wasn't he?
Yes, he was also an elf.
Yeah. I can't remember that guy's name.
But he won an Emmy.
Cool. I like that guy. Peter Dinklage, right?
Yes, Peter Dinklage.
Yeah. Okay.
And, of course, this is one that I'm kind of bummed about, but we're not getting the Dark Knight Rises prologue in Kansas City.
Yeah, I told you it was going to happen.
Closest one's going to be in Des Moines that we can go see it at.
Road trip. Yeah,
in other words,
I'm not going to
see it until it hits online or
something.
Yeah,
I'm going to have to torrent it or something.
So, but that also means you don't have to go see Mission Impossible 3 or 4, whichever freaking Mission Impossible.
Yeah, 17. I knew that it was playing. It was only playing at the high definition IMAX theaters, and I was almost positive that the ones in KC weren't.
That's kind of annoying, but you know, I think it's AMC. AMC theaters is based out of Kansas City. I think they kind of dropped the ball on this.
I'll give you that.
That they didn't get it in their hometown.
So. I'll give you that, but you know, at the same time, I can't say I care that much. I'd like to see it, and you know, honestly, yeah. we live in a world with the internet and.
Yeah,
torrent and stuff like that.
We'll see it. You know, I mean, it'll hit online somewhere.
Sure. And also, you know, I'll see it when I see the movie.
Yeah. And speaking of Dark Knight, we have the viral marketing has kicked into gear today again. So,
yeah.
Why don't you talk about that? You've had a better look at it.
I've barely had a look at it. But what happened is on Wired.com, there were two images. Well. I guess we can call them images, but basically what it is they released on Wired.com, and they are a heavily redacted CIA bulletin
and a
transcript.
Yeah, another transcript document.
That is that looks like a profile on a Dr. Leonid Pavel, and basically the long and short of it.
A Russian nuclear physicist.
A Russian nuclear physicist. And looking over
missing.
The transcript, he is missing. Looking over the transcript, which also is heavily redacted, it was basically a conversation between
some militia
member and we don't know.
Yeah.
Also heavily redacted.
Yes.
What I'm looking at is we have the Russians in here, and we have a doctor who's working with... basically working to help find somebody. And we also have it, the Russians and Georgians.
Because there's some talk in there about the Doctor.
The Doctor.
And they refer then to Dr. Pavel.
Right, so, which points to Hugo Strange.
Yeah, which could be interesting. I mean, it's obviously the ARG for Dark Knight Rises. And
The ARG?
Alternate Reality Game.
Ah, okay.
That's what they call them. But the one they did for The Dark Knight was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. It's not anything that I'm smart enough to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I figured that out really quickly.
Yeah,
I don't have the time to do it.
Sit back and see what happens, you know?
Well, it was just like that the thing with the Fire Rises website and how fast people found that Twitter feed.
Yeah.
That just blew my mind. And I found this, like, pretty quickly. I mean, I found this online an hour within a leak, and as soon as I got it, I plugged it into Photoshop, and I started doing all this stuff and, you know, doing a... reverse image, and I'm not finding anything. So I think what it is it's whatever it's leading to. So that's kind of cool. When it comes down to it, Dark Knight Rises is still coming out July 20th, 2012, and I'm still going to go see it.
And we got a bunch of trailers that I spotted this week.
Yeah, but I didn't watch any of them.
Well, there's a new trailer out for, and this movie kind of slipped under the radar, called The Darkest Hour. It comes out Christmas Day. It's about this invisible aliens that attack Earth.
Neat.
Yeah, but it really sort of reminds me of Skyline, so it's probably going to really suck. Because Skyline was shit.
That's what you said. I didn't want to see it, and in between what you're telling me and what Bag and Boardcast is saying, I'm just like,
don't.
I'm not going to bother.
Brain-sucking aliens, there you go.
Neat.
And I'm not
Starship
joking.
Troopers.
Yeah, Starship Troopers did it better. the trailer for Cabin in the Woods, produced by Joss Whedon, is out. And it actually looks pretty interesting. It's not just a straight horror movie.
Cool.
It's got some weird sci-fi elements to it, which look kind of intriguing. Plus, it's got Thor in it.
It does have Thor in it. It'd be cool if it was Thor, but it's actually Hemsworth, so...
And there's another sci-fi movie coming out called Lockout. It's a European one with Guy Pearce, and apparently he plays a prisoner in a high-security space prison.
Cool.
And the trailer for it is just him getting the crap beat out of him in an interrogation, but doesn't reveal really anything about the movie. But hey, it could be interesting.
Cool. That would be interesting.
We also got a new trailer for The Gray. Mainly because it's Liam fucking Neeson.
Yeah. That I have seen.
And it's Liam fucking Neeson, you know, fighting wolves.
Excellent.
So that can never be crazy. And we got Mark Strong alerts here.
Woohoo!
The movie comes out in limited release this coming Friday on December 9th is Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
That's got Gary Oldman in it.
It's got everybody in it.
It does. And that might be Gary Oldman's first Oscar nomination.
Mark Strong is in it. It looks very cool.
Yeah.
I'm very interested. And this is another one, Mark Strong alert, was the newest trailer for John Carter.
He's in that?
Yes, he is.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know it either until I saw him. Was like, holy crap, I ran it back. That is Mark Strong.
Very cool.
So, hey, one more reason to see John Carter. And actually, that movie looks pretty cool.
It looks interesting. I'm not sure if that's one that I'd make it to the theater to see, but I would like to see it.
Well, it's Pixar. It's Disney.
Yeah.
It's Pixar's first live-action movie.
Correct.
So I'm really interested. And it's coming out in March, so, I mean, it's not like it's going to be up against anything.
True.
I mean, it might be up against, you know, Ghost Rider.
I thought that comes out in January.
I don't fucking care.
Ghost Rider 2 or...
Who cares?
Something.
It looks like shit, but, you know. That's all I got.
See, I disagree. I think it looks good CGI-wise. Story-wise, it might suck. But,
yeah, the CGI looks good.
I thought the CGI looks really good. All right, this is my last little bit of news. It's not really relevant to the Red Phone Zone. It's just something that I found interesting and terrifying all at the same time. It was, man finds enormous giant weta, single largest insect on record. I want to show the picture to Ethan.
Yes, I have seen that, actually.
That is...
That's a creepy ass.
Fucking terrifying. It's a picture of a guy holding a bug and in his hand, and it's holding a carrot, and it's... got the whole damn carrot in its mouth.
Yep.
It's really scary to me. It was found by former park ranger Mark Moffitt on Little Bear Island in New Zealand, the only place where giant wettas are known to currently live. Moffat was actually looking for the bugs, so the discovery was something to be celebrated, not something to be feared or haunted by, as I initially assumed upon seeing the picture. It has a wingspan of about 7 inches and weighs as much as 3 mice, so 2 or 3 pounds, I'm thinking. It also has the ability to eat your dreams and literally frighten your heart out.
Depends on where you are in the mice, I mean.
Well, that's true. And if in... to me, it's just terrifying. I mean, I know this is a audio podcast, and I'm talking about a picture, but check it out. I found it on...
Where is this?
It's all around. It was on
Geekosystem.com, but it's all over the place. And I, for one, want to...
I'm personally waiting for the sci-fi original movie featuring the giant weta.
Sure.
Megabug versus...
Sharktopus.
Sharktopus.
Yeah, Sharktopus versus Giant Weta.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, for one, want to welcome and praise our Weta overlords.
Yes.
These things are terrifying and scary to me. These are as big as like a kitten, and it's a bug. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But,
well, we got spiders that are pretty huge down in the jungles.
But that big?
Yeah, yeah.
This looks like fucking Hobbit big, you know. To, you know, like, I mean, like a Hobbit
big,
movie
right?
big. Shelob. I mean, this is really, really big, and it's scary because it's real.
Huh.
But yeah, that just terrified me, and I wanted to talk about it. Have you seen this, Christopher?
No, sir, I have not.
It's a big, scary bug.
It's a big bug eating a carrot.
Gotten that impression.
It's a big bug eating a carrot, and I'm not really scared of bugs and stuff like that. And so
no, but if that was crawling in through your front window,
I'd shoot it with a bazooka if I had a bazooka. I'd probably sick Bella after it.
Yeah,
my dog, and
Bella
she'd get eaten.
Lose.
Yeah, probably. But unless Christopher, do you have anything to bring up or to add about anything?
Well, just one brief thing. Okay. You know, as a guy who finds the '60s Dragnet the most hypnotically watchable show ever created, I just want to take a second and acknowledge the passing of Harry Morgan at the ripe age of 96, and wish him a pleasant journey to a much better world.
Made more famous by MASH.
Yeah,
that's what he's getting most credit for. But yes, he was. He wasn't Friday, was he?
No, he was. He was Joe Gannon. He was the weird guy who played off of Jack Webb.
Yes. Just the facts, man.
Just the facts. Yeah, I saw that, and it was sad. I saw it all over Facebook and stuff, and you're right. People are talking about him from MASH, and I saw the name, and I immediately thought Dragnet.
Myself.
That is a good show, though. That's a really good show.
Yep.
Oh, I adore that show.
Okay, well, that is going to bring an end to Geekly Happenings. Stay tuned. We're going to be right back with our main topic discussion where we discuss comedy films.
Remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 90 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour, the galaxy we call the Milky Way.
And we are back. We just talked Geekly Happenings with our guest host, Christopher McLaughlin, and it was super fun. But now we're going to be doing a segment that we're going to be changing it up a bit on you, because this is not Christopher's choice. This is mine. But like I said, he's been one of my favorite guests, and I wanted to do this one right. So I wanted to talk comedy films tonight. Now, I don't know about you, but we got Christopher here, we got myself, we got Ethan, and Rachel's in the room. I bet you all four of us would come up with four different types of comedies that we like.
Oh, yeah.
That's something that's so common in these discussions, that we come up with four diametrically different lists.
Doing this list, it became very apparent to me that I am not a fan of a lot of comedies.
And I knew that before I made my list, but... that's why I kind of wanted to make this list, because when it comes to my comedic mind, I'm out of time.
Sure. Well,
I'm absolutely out of time.
I am not a fan of most contemporary comedy.
I do have a couple that came out in my lifetime, but most of them are not.
Yes. I mean, so do I. But yeah, most of the comedies that come out now I find kind of, well, stupid. So,
well,
like I saw The Hangover and thought it was one of the dumbest things I'd ever seen.
I liked The Hangover, but it's still not, it's not my speed. I mean, I admired it for not being as stupid as American Pie or something like that. You know, it's it might not be your thing, but it's not stupid. It was not unintelligent. It actually had a story thread going through it, and it did come together in the end, so to speak.
Yeah. And I want to say on my list, there's probably two movies that have come out in the last 5 years.
In the last 5 years.
I think. But the truth be told,
I've got,
you know, I was
two.
I've never been a big fan of a lot of comedy.
Well,
for a comedy to be funny to me, it has to be
smart.
It has to be smart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it has to not treat me like I'm, you know, a 2-year-old and an idiot.
Now, I'm not going to say that Ethan and I are, you know, worthless pieces of shit, but we're not funny people either, not particularly.
No, we're funny looking. We're
funny looking, and we do funny things, but you know, we're not the life of the parties, and we don't make people laugh.
We got faces for radio.
We got faces for radio. That's right. Now on what do Christopher, are you a fan of comedies at all?
Well, generally speaking, yes, but I have a very, very, very odd, undefinable thing, list of things that make me laugh. And I have a tendency to just obsess over the same dozen or so comedies rather than just being able to laugh at anything. There are times I wish I really could do that. But, you know, as it is, I tend to latch on to a funny film and then just watch it through five or six media and, you know, just keep coming back to it year after year after year.
And there are comedies out there that I like.
Me too.
But I wouldn't, by any means, when I was creating my list of stuff, okay, top 10, I didn't even think of putting them on there. Because I was like, I like that movie, but eh.
Well, when we did our top 6.
It's kind of funny.
Our top 10 films?
No, when I was doing this list.
Okay.
When I was thinking of, you know,
sure.
You know, comedies, there were ones out there that just did not make the cut for me at, like, even second thought type of thing.
Well, whenever we do a list, it doesn't matter if it's comedy or if it's supernatural films, one of the first things I do is I look at my DVD shelf.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't have any comedies, hardly. I mean, I have a few.
Neither do I.
And they're not mine. They're Rachel's. And it's not because I don't like them. It's because I don't really have an answer.
I do have movies that I consider funny but weren't intentionally funny.
Exactly. You know, like
I do own Death Race.
Yeah,
that movie's hysterical, but
and
it's
like,
not a comedy.
I find so much stuff in No Country for Old Men hysterical, but I cannot put that on here as a comedy, or
no,
I'd be flayed alive, and rightfully so. But I look at comedies. If you're a fan of film, you cannot discount comedies. It's the oldest, and it's probably the most diverse genre out there.
Yeah.
And I think
it's not the oldest.
It's amongst the oldest. Yeah. But
we already established that Westerns are the
Westerns
oldest.
Is the oldest American. But when you get back into...
Westerns are the oldest film genre in existence.
Well, kind of, sort of, yeah.
You could make an argument that porn is the oldest.
Well, that's true.
Really, but
that's true. That is, are we going to do top 6 porn anytime soon? Probably not.
I think I've seen 6 pornos.
I've definitely seen 6 pornos, but I couldn't tell you the name of it, most of them, except for, like, Fuck My Dirty Shithole and Pirates. But that's neither here nor there. When I look at a list of comedy films, I honestly look at it kind of sadly, because it's like Ethan and I just keep saying that we're not a big fan of most of the comedies that are coming out these days. The shock comedies, the grossed out comedies, they're just not for me, and I find them really unintelligent. And I also look at comedies. You can look at them in different decades. The 90s and the 2000s, the shock out gross comedies were the big ones. And you look at the 80s, and there was like a lot of like spoofs and farces and stuff like that.
Yeah,
you know,
that really a Revenge of the Nerds type of stuff.
like stuff like that. Yeah. You get into the 70s was actually a pretty good time for comedies.
They were a bit more sophisticated. Annie Hall.
Yeah, you had your Annie Halls, MASH, just stuff like that. But you also had stuff like
they're a bit more cynical.
A much, much, much more cynical.
But I mean, that was the time there.
But that's kind of where I'm working towards. You look at a comedy and the time it comes out, it's almost always a mirror of society at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I do find that people are becoming more unintelligent these days.
Yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't take much to make them laugh.
Much more would be considered lowbrow.
Yes, ma'am. What? They'll print. It's not going to hurt anything. Sorry. But anything else to add, Christopher?
Oh, no. I'm ready to get into it.
You're ready to get into it?
All right.
So why don't we just go ahead and start off our list. Ethan, what's your number 6 favorite comedy?
My number 6 favorite comedy, and you know, with the caveat for all this list always, is, you know, you ask me tomorrow and my list would probably be different. But right now my number 6 is, I think this movie came out in 1988, 89. It's Without a Clue. With Ben Kingsley, Michael Caine.
Oh, okay, the Sherlock Holmes.
Comedy.
Yeah.
That was a fantastic movie. I really enjoyed that one. For people who don't know anything about Without a Clue, it's a comedy that supposes what if Watson was the actual brilliant one and Holmes was not. In the movie, Holmes is actually portrayed by Michael Caine, who is an actor that Watson hired to play the part of Sherlock Holmes because he was a doctor in medical school when he first helped solve a case, and he didn't want to get involved in it, so he said he got it from this Sherlock Holmes. And, of course, then it sort of spiraled out of control, and now then everybody wanted Sherlock Holmes' help. And so he got this actor who is a drunkard and a womanizer and everything. And you get this great team-up in this movie with Ben Kingsley and Michael Caine dealing with, of course, the villain is Moriarty, who knows that Watson is, of course, the intelligent one and Holmes is an idiot. And it's a great team up because you have this this straight man in Ben Kingsley, and it's one of those movies that Ben Kingsley did that, you know, I hope he's not ashamed of doing.
Mm-hmm.
But you have Ben Kingsley, Michael Caine, two phenomenal actors pulling off this great part, and Inspector Lestrade is Inspector Lestrade in the movie is played by a much more regular funny man. Whose name sort of escapes me right now, but I'll find it here in a minute.
Just keep talking. I'll look.
The movie is great. It has some great funny bits in it. It didn't obviously make it, you know, hugely high on my list, and it's one of those movies I saw when I was a kid, and I remember vividly watching it numerous times on VHS. And especially with the like lately right now, is you have all these different iterations of Sherlock Holmes popping up with, you know, Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, dude, it was Jeffrey Jones. I thought so. I wanted to look that up, but I
couldn't remember his name. And it is a very, very, very funny movie. And
I'm a fan.
With these different iterations of Sherlock Holmes coming out now, it's kind of fun to go back and watch this because, I mean, at that same time period, you had, you know, the young Sherlock Holmes movie.
That was a good movie, too.
That was not a bad movie, no, which came out around the same time as this one, I believe. But Without a Clue, I don't know who directed it off the top of my head.
Tom Wilkinson or something like that? I don't remember
I don't think
name.
It's Tom Wilkinson.
Tom
that's
something.
An actor. But it is a good movie. I highly recommend it, Without a Clue.
Have you seen that one, Christopher?
Yeah, I saw it when it first came out on video cassette. Oh, my. Aren't we showing our age?
Oh, yeah. We're not so young as to where we don't remember video cassettes. So when I first met Ethan, he had hundreds of and hundreds lining his walls and stuff. But, really. No, it's a good movie. I would highly recommend it. I forgot about that movie, but I've seen it in the last year or so. I enjoy it. It's a good one.
It was one of the ones that came right to mind when I was going to do this listening. It's one of those that has got a soft spot in my heart for it, and I was like, you know what? I really enjoy that movie.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Christopher, what's your number six?
This is the start of a list that I almost feel like I have to apologize for because I've sort of prided myself on being able to come up with at least one really, really off-the-wall choice. And I went over this list, and at least to me, everything I have on here is such an obvious choice. I feel like such a sheep compared to some of the more iconoclastic things that I have come up with. So let me apologize in advance if there are like no surprises here.
Okay.
Maybe I'll surprise people with how low this is.
Okay.
But when I actually sat down and ranked them, the number six one was Airplane.
Airplane is my number five.
Yes.
I love Airplane, actually.
Yes.
I enjoy Airplane. I enjoy Airplane. Didn't even make my top 10.
I love that movie, and I completely admit that it's lowbrow, and it might take away a little bit of my intelligence, but it's a fun movie.
But here's the thing. I just revisited it on Blu-ray, and
Don't Call Me Shirley edition? Yep.
Yeah.
Well, they put that out in standard. They basically recycled all the features and stuff that for the Blu-ray.
Yeah. Sure.
But you know, and there is some lowbrow stuff in there. But what's funny to me is this, and unfortunately, that's the lesson that everybody that's been imitating this film for the last 30 years, that's what they accepted of it.
Yeah.
But to me, the parts of that film really work are either just inexplicably funny, or just actors playing against type.
Like the Florence that, Henderson,
or at the time Leslie Nielsen.
Florence Henderson's in the sequel.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. Who the hell played the jive talking lady?
Barbara Billingsley.
There we go. Yeah. There we go.
Mrs.
Sorry,
Cleaver. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, you know, beyond the obvious stuff that most people remember, here's the two things that actually really, really, really blew me away, having seen it for the umpteenth million time, but first time in high def. Okay. I developed an all-new appreciation for Steven Stucker's Johnny.
Uh-huh. He's funny.
You know, I defy anyone to keep a straight face through. And Leon's getting...
Yes.
Uh-huh.
You know, for my very, very last faculty meeting, I'm actually gonna go in character as Johnny. Excellent. And like heckle my principal as Johnny. No, so that's how I'm gonna exit public education.
To stop sniffing glue.
I do that. That's actually a part of my vernacular. Mm-hmm. It's yes. Like, you know, something bad happens in my life. Oh man, did I pick the wrong day to quit sniffing glue?
Yeah. And this is a movie you can sort of peg as the start of that type of movie. Because, you know, you get Hot Shots and Hot Shots Part 2 and Spy Hard and all that all sort of dovetailed off of this movie. And this was obviously a big parody at the time of the disaster films that were coming out. And talk about, you know, a different, because Airplane is good. Airplane. Obviously it's a parody, you know, like the airport movies, you know, the disaster movies from the 70s.
Interesting story about that. You know, the direct forebear of Airplane was actually a 1957 Dana Andrews Canadian film called Zero Hour.
Oh, yeah?
And God bless Turner Classic Movies, I've actually seen Zero Hour. And it's pretty frightening. I mean, that they paid the guy off. The guy who wrote Zero Hour got a check for Airplane. There was no deliberate ripoff. But they've stolen huge chunks of dialogue straight from Zero Hour and have just delivered them in just that trademark Airplane style, and all of a sudden they become hilarious. And it was funny because Zero Hour is played perfectly straight, but just hearing, recognizing the words from Airplane, they're hilarious now. You really see what turned Zucker Abram Zucker onto doing a comedy version of this film. And if you love Airplane, it's worth tracking down Zero Hour at least once
and watch,
just to see the forebears of it.
Back, it sounds like it would be an entertaining thing.
That would be perfect. That would be the perfect DVD extra for that.
It's a fun thing to look at now because you had, you know, Airplane and where it was as it was a reaction to those disaster movies. Whereas you have movies like that now, but they're nowhere near as funny because, you know, you had Scary Movie 1 through 38 and Epic Movie and all that crap. That are nowhere near as funny as what Airplane.
Well, they've decided to make a whole 80-minute film based on the random shot where the topless woman runs through the aisle. Yeah. Essentially,
yes,
exactly.
I don't like those
movies because they're too topical. Sorry,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and I'm much more enamored of like that bizarre speech that Robert Stack is going through at the end of the movie.
Yeah,
municipal bonds, Ted. I'm talking AA rating. Best investment in America.
And that movie was a great, you know, sort of put it on its ear movie where they had these very serious actors come in and do these off-the-wall, really comedic performances. Robert Stack is, you know, a great example. Beau Bridges. Leslie Nielsen, you know.
Yeah.
It's like people who had never done that sort of thing before.
That was Lloyd Bridges, not Beau Bridges.
Yeah.
Lloyd Bridges.
Poor Peter Graves.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, God, yes.
I loved him in that movie. He was so funny in that movie.
The best DVD extra on there is him explaining how they actually talked him into saying those lines in the script.
Yeah.
Yep.
That must have been some sell job.
Yeah. This is a movie that I like. I mean, I'm fully aware that it's silly, but at the same time there is some intelligence to it. It's not necessarily related, but a movie that I liked an awful lot growing up, Hear No Evil, See No Evil. Hear No Evil, See No Evil with Pryor and Wilder. Was also directed by the Zuckers, and I didn't know that till the other day.
You know, say whatever else you want about Airplane, it brings the funny.
It does.
Seriously, that was my sole criteria for putting this list together. It brings the funny.
I think my view of the movie has been unfortunately colored by the subsequent basically ripoffs of it, and that just sort of reflects poorly on me as a viewer. I think. So.
I do find it.
It is funny.
Unmistakably funny, and it's one of those movies that I do like. I did toy with actually putting it on my top six
films of all time when we did it, but mm-hmm. I don't think I could. I was able to fit it on there, but well, I do like it an awful lot.
Well, what's your number six, Aaron?
Speaking of my top six films of all time, I'm going to open up with the only one that was on my top six films list of all time. It was the 2008 Tropic Thunder.
That's my number five.
Really enjoy that movie. It's, I'm going to say, I said it last time, I'm saying it now. I'm not going to sing its praises because sure. it's not as great as some other comedies going to be on this sure. list. It's one that directly speaks to me as a fan of film, as a big fan of Robert Downey Jr., as a fan of this whole entire medium. It just really spoke
to
me.
Ben Stiller, Jack Black. I mean, I sort of judge a lot of movies as how funny they are. Did it make me laugh so hard that I literally had tears running down my face?
That one
this
did.
Movie had me laughing so hard that
mm-hmm.
happened. So,
mm-hmm.
And to me, it was like I said, it's my number five, mm-hmm. and it made it onto my list as a because I thought it was a smart comedy.
Yeah,
and, it really didn't take itself seriously. It just had the right balance of tongue in cheek and that seriousness. But I mean. You had such good actors in there doing this stuff, and comedy is hard.
Yeah.
So first thing you really had to understand, especially as an actor, is comedy is very difficult, because you got to get that timing, and you got to sell this fact that you're Robert Downey Jr. who's painted up as a black man.
Yeah, which was hilarious.
Yeah, and
but what was funnier about it was he was he actually had plastic surgery to become a black
yes.
man, which makes you think of. What's he going to do after this role? And it's really funny. I really do enjoy that movie a lot.
Oh, yes. It's definitely a hysterical film.
Have you seen that one, Christopher?
Oh, yeah. And honestly, enjoyed it more than I have in any comedy I've seen in a year.
It was one of those that I really didn't want to see.
I wanted to see it because I was curious about Robert Downey Jr. playing the black dude.
Yeah, enough people told me, it's actually really, really funny.
Yeah.
I will completely... say that I fall into that, and I did eventually succumb and see The Hangover. I succumbed and saw this one and was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah,
and I mean it is directed by Ben Stiller, mm-hmm. Who is actually a pretty good comedy director.
He
is.
He's hit and miss.
Yeah, he is hit and miss. This one though definitely hit. It has the right balance of everything in this movie. It's just really really really. Really fucking funny.
Yeah.
And I mean, there were points in this movie where I'm just like, can't breathe. It's so hilarious.
I think the part that had me laughing the absolute hardest was when his adopted kid started stabbing
yes.
him. That just and then he threw him off the bridge just unceremoniously,
yes.
just threw him off the bridge
and
to his
so
death.
It was so obviously fake.
Yeah. I also liked the director, Damien Cockburn.
Yeah, when he died.
When he died, he stepped on the landmine.
Yes.
That was just so out of left field. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
Funny movie. I really enjoyed it, and it's one of the probably the most recent comedy that I really enjoyed.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the two on my list that are in the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah. So, excellent. Brings us on to Christopher's number five.
Number five, a film that does that rare thing of bringing the funny from start to finish. Just 90 minutes of solid laughter, at least for me. The classic, the original, The Jerk.
That's a good movie. I haven't seen that in a while, and I didn't really think about it, but yeah, it's a good one.
I haven't seen it in the longest time. but back when I saw it, I wasn't a huge Steve Martin fan, so it didn't make my list, and...
Well, I can pay it this tribute. You guys are well aware of my experiences this summer. I can actually say I know what it's like to hit bottom in your life.
Sure.
And I can I can say this with no exaggeration. On the worst day of my life, I can still fall out of a chair laughing at He Hates These Cans.
Yeah. That's a hilarious movie. It didn't occur to me, but I do like that one an awful lot. So, cool.
And yeah, I'm one to throw out a random movie quote on my Facebook feed just to see who gets it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got 45 responses to "He totally ran that other cup of pizza guy out of business."
Yep.
I knew that this was a film that had touched people's lives in a very serious and wonderful way. So, terrific movie. Never gotten the treatment it deserves on DVD, but still in all, just 90 minutes of solid funny, and you can't hate that.
Nope. Well, you can if you're a big old jerk. That's wonderful.
Nice.
Zing.
Yeah.
But no, it's a wonderful film. Once again, I do recommend people absolutely check that out if they haven't seen it. And if you haven't seen it, I feel sorry for you. It's one of those simple pleasures in life. Mm-hmm. So, excellent. That brings us to Ethan. My number five was Airplane, so it brings us on to Ethan's number four.
All right. My number four is the next movie that was within the last 5 or 10 years. It is a movie that really sort of, to me, embodies sort of this smart, witty, witty and damn entertaining comedy. It's the 2007 movie Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, I like that one. I didn't think about that.
Directed by Edgar Wright, starring Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, and everyone else. I just watched this movie again the other day, and god damn, is it funny. The thing I like about it is it's a really smart... It's one of those movies that the DVD has, and the Blu-ray anyway, has a...
those are great DVDs and Blu-rays.
Has a trivia track that you can watch it, and there's so many nods to famous cop movies.
Oh, yeah. They're all over the place.
Dirty Harry and Bullet and things like that. They're all over the place with these, and it's just so much fun to see how they tie these lines together, and then from the beginning to the end, and by the end it just becomes such an outlandish farce that you just accept it and move on. You have this great comedy team with Nick Frost and Simon Pegg doing this absolutely hysterical, basically this English Bobby, this English cop film done in the style of an American or Hong Kong action flick. You know, you have Simon Pegg jumping around and Nick Frost jumping around with two guns jumping through the air. It is by far, I think, my favorite action comedy out there. Whereas you have different ones out there. This one has just a great balance of a great script, great actors, great filmmaking, and I think it's probably Edgar Wright's best film so far.
When I saw that movie, you and I mean, we never fell out of speaking terms. We never hated each other, but we weren't, we weren't talking as often as we are now and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The moment I saw that movie, I'm like, this is a movie that was made for Ethan, if there was ever a movie made for Ethan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I love it. I think it's a great film. I still prefer Shaun of the Dead
I love Shaun of the Dead.
I know you do, and I love Hot Fuzz. I just prefer
one. What Shaun of the Dead was for zombie film fans, this movie was for me.
Which is, exactly.
I'm such a fan of the action.
Exactly, and I grew up on the Friday the 13th and crap like that, so.
And don't get me wrong, Shaun of the Dead's damn hysterical.
And same with Hot Fuzz, so, I don't know. It's a great film. Have you seen that one, Christopher?
You know, I haven't. Honestly, the two of you, I think I'm closer to your feelings about this, Aaron. I thought it was a fine film, but gosh, I was just so mightily impressed by Shaun of the Dead. And
it suffers by comparison. It does. And it's too bad because this is a really good movie. And but one of my things that I took out of it was I was surprised at how much Simon Pegg acted in it. I mean, he was nothing like Sean from Shaun of the Dead in that movie. He worked with a trainer to get in better shape because what was that? Nick Angel. The Nick Angel character would not be a flabby stoner guy. So he went and worked with a trainer and got in shape. And I also kind of like the fact that when Nick Frost's character, when they went and got drunk and started watching these action movies, they were watching stupid action movies.
Yeah.
They were watching, Point Blank and Bad Boys 2. Not Bad Boys 1, but Bad Boys 2.
Yes.
And I just kind of, that was one of those things. I thought that Nick Frost was, I thought he was such a sweet character in that movie. I mean, he played Ed in Shaun of the Dead, and he was an idiot in Shaun of the Dead, but he was just such a sweet character in this movie, and I did like that movie a lot. And
and you're right, it's definitely a movie that was made for me.
Yeah, and I do like it a lot, and I'm not trying to speak down to it. I'm just saying that I love Shaun of the Dead, I guess.
Yeah, no, and I love Shaun of the Dead as well.
Sure.
So.
Cool. Bringing us on to Christopher's number four.
Well, again, Captain Obvious strikes again. I had to put This Is Spinal Tap on there somewhere. Because
good movie. It's turning it up to 11.
So your list goes up to 11?
Does your list go up to 11?
indeed it does. And the fact that we were talking about that instead of, Veterans Day, you know, Armistice Day, end of World War I, the fact that this two-minute scene in that movie can overshadow one of our major holidays and a major historical event, I mean, that's a film that's done something pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, and it's just it's another film I got to revisit recently on Blu-ray, and I marvel.
Was that on Blu-ray?
Yes.
Oh, cool! I should check that out.
Yeah, it was a bit of a letdown though, because they had originally announced that they were going to salvage the commentary track that's only available on the long out of print and now selling for $1,000 a copy Criterion edition to it. But unfortunately,
This Is Spinal Tap was on Criterion.
Yeah.
Yes, it was one of their very first releases, and I think we've all listened to the in character commentary track. They did an out of character commentary track for the Criterion edition where they talk about all the stuff.
No,
that
they had that
miracle
video. Mm-hmm. For $1,000, Christopher?
I've seen it going for a grand on eBay, yeah.
I don't want to get your hopes up. Let me run to the local video store. If I find it, I'll pick it up for you.
And I sir, will deed you a kidney if you need one.
Okay, but let me go look. But they did have an American video, now that you've mentioned that. I completely forgotten about it, but yes.
I remember they had the Laserdisc.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Well, seriously, if you want to keep it and make a down payment on your house with it, I would not begrudge you that, because you could do that.
Well, maybe.
Yeah, but so get back to the film. Back to the film. Sorry. But, you know, I mean, it's just...
I don't want to derail you again, but did Christopher Guest direct that?
Rob Reiner.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Continue.
I mean, it's utterly hilarious. It's a perfect satire of an admitted subculture, but one that's had tremendous artistic and cultural impact on our society at large. And, you know, just capturing it manages to capture the grandeur and the absurdity of rock music, which, you know, as Cameron Crowe points out, is probably the silliest thing in the world to love, but, you know, you love what you love. And this in a way is kind of a Valentine to, you know, it's wonderful, wonderful ridiculousness of it all. And honestly, you know, one thing I got from the Blu-ray is how marvelously well drawn out these characters really are.
Right.
It's no wonder that they're actually touring as a real band and, you know, doing talk show appearances in character. Because they really do inhabit these people. And it's a marvelous film.
It really is. It really is a good film. I haven't seen it in a while, but you've got me curious. If I can get that, I probably will. I probably will take a look at it before I ship it your way. But I haven't seen it in a while. It's a really good movie, and I can't tell you how many times on this show have we quoted "Turning It Up to 11." I mean, obviously, it's penetrated our lexicon.
All the way up to 11.
Yeah, it goes all the way up to 11.
Yeah, and it's one of the first movies you could really label as that mockumentary.
Oh, sure.
But obviously, it's a rockumentary. But yeah, damn funny.
Well, it's the first one to do it for comedy.
Oh yeah, I actually hadn't seen it for a long, long time until probably within the last 5 years, and that is a darn funny movie.
And really, seriously, another thing I can recommend about the Blu-ray is the sound mix is just so much better. I mean, it really the music really pops with the Blu-ray. It's worth getting just for the sound mix.
Cool. That is excellent.
You will never think of Big Bottom the same way again until you hear that bass run through a proper sound system.
That would be awesome.
Yes.
That would be absolutely awesome. I guess we're on to my number four now.
Yep.
Okay, my number four. I'm looking at my list of what I've gone through so far, and I'm a damn liar. I said there was only two that came out in my lifetime. There's several on my list that have come out in my lifetime.
You're an old bastard like me.
Apparently, but this is one that it's becoming apparent looking at my list. A minute ago, when Christopher was talking, I was looking over my list, thinking that his list, as always, is trumping mine, and wasn't very, very pleased with it. And then I'm looking at my list, and this is a list that really speaks to me. And you know, I'm not saying that these are the best films ever made or anything like that, but the ones that they're important to me, and especially when they came out, they spoke to me. My number four came out in 1994, and it was Kevin Smith's debut film, Clerks. Mm-hmm. I love that movie. I still love that movie.
obviously, you know, I look at it now, and it definitely has its problems. Kevin Smith is not a great director.
No,
I'm not ever going
to
say he is.
That movie definitely does speak to you, especially if you've worked in jobs like that. It's one of those things like Office Space and this. That, you know, it's like, okay, you know, I've been there, so I can appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, we have those conversations about Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, you have those conversations about Jaws and being scared of sitting on the toilet
Salsa
when you're a
shark.
Kid. Salsa Shark. And we've all had those awful days where everything goes wrong and, you know, there's gum in our shutters and we have to play hockey on the roof and go to a wake and knock over the casket. This is a movie that I do like a lot, and Ethan nailed it because, you know, I've been that goddamn clerk. I have worked in a video store with Ethan. I was the Randall. He was more the Dante.
Yep.
I've worked in a gas station. I was the Randall. I'm just kind of the Randall. Yep. I'm the smart ass guy that sits behind the counter and bitches about the customers. And I do like it a lot. If I look at the entirety of Kevin Smith's work, I would have to say that my favorite film he's done is the sequel to Clerks, Clerks 2. but I do think that Clerks is probably more important in my development of films and enjoying of movies, and I do like that movie a lot. It was important when it came out. It's probably not as important now. Kevin Smith has been doing some really boneheaded things lately. I do still like him a lot.
He's done some really crappy movies lately too.
Well, sure, but at the same time, he also gave us Clerks, which is good.
Very oddly, you know, making this list, I didn't put any of the Kevin Smith movies on here, and I do like the Kevin Smith movies for the most part, but yeah, this one just, none of them really were like, yeah, top 10 right there, boom.
Well, Clerks was for me, because I like Kevin Smith a lot. Maybe I shouldn't, but I do, and I like watching his movies, so, and I had to put Clerks in here, because it was a big movie that came out. I saw it, like, when it came out in the theater. I saw it at Liberty Hall, and I loved it. So, that's my number four. Bring us on to Ethan's number three.
My number three is a movie that appeared on my top 10 movies of all time list. It is the classic, in my opinion, the 1974 Monty Python and the Holy Grail. If anyone hasn't seen that movie, you are probably been living under a rock, especially if you're a gamer, because this is probably the most often quoted thing at a gaming table ever. And it is Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Is my number seven.
See,
I put on number seven because I knew it was going to pop up on your list.
Sure. And Monty Python and the Holy Grail, what more can I say about this movie for those who haven't seen it? It's the story of, you know, King Arthur and his search for the Holy Grail, but done by Monty Python in only the way Monty Python can do things. Coconuts instead of horses, and I fart in your general direction. It's just outlandish, crazy Monty Python British humor done to the T. Absolutely horribly low-budget movie that has become such a huge classic.
You know what sucks? Is I discovered Monty Python late in life.
Yeah.
I was probably I didn't discover him when I was a child. I discovered I was 18, 19 years old, right?
Mm-hmm.
And 18, 19, I was, or it would have been, you know, 97, 98, 99, around that time. And so I started watching all these movies, and, you know, I was loving them. I watched that. I watched Flying Circus. I watched Life of Brian, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the one Monty Python performer I was always gravitating towards is Graham Chapman. And so I did a little bit of research. I found out the motherfucker was dead. That made me so mad because I loved Graham Chapman. And obviously I like Terry Gilliam and John Cleese and all the rest of them, but I just always enjoyed Graham Chapman. And
oh, yeah.
It annoyed me that the one that
you
liked
enjoy
was dead.
Graham Chapman, the movie to watch is Life of Brian.
No shit. That's a great movie.
But for me,
also has a Criterion.
Yes. Yes. It does. This movie, though, Holy Grail, just sort of stands out to me as just sort of this outlandish, off-the-wall...
The message for you, sir, thing is my ringtone for a...
Message for us, huh?
Yeah, that's the ringtone for my text on my phone.
Yeah, it's a movie that is so probably one of the most quotable movies of all time. So
I got into an argument with a dude at my old job who said he didn't like Monty Python because all their movies were stupid and unintelligent. And
Oh, I totally disagree with the unintelligent business there.
That's what I'm saying is I watch these movies, and they have their childness to them, but if they're anything, they're intelligent.
Yeah.
And I just could not understand how somebody could look at it and see it so much differently than I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it so frustrating, and I wanted to fire the guy when it happened, but it wasn't cool. I do like Monty Python a lot. Have you? You've seen this, Christopher?
Oh, yes.
Cool.
Yes. And honestly, you know, it's a film that I enjoy tremendously. Didn't make my list, though. I may have to hand in my geek card admitting that. But just, number one, it's never been my favorite Python film. And secondly, I have maybe a unique form of damage with that film, if that's the word to use, I once gifted my good friend and now gaming industry cohort Hal Mangold with the limited edition script book for that film.
Right.
And it just so happened that it was like a week before I could give it to him. So, you know, I read the darn thing, you know. Yep. So, you know, I mean, that's probably like horrible gift etiquette. But Hal knew. He was cool with it. And it actually had all three scripts, including the two they didn't film.
Mm-hmm.
And the ending to the second draft is so much better than what they actually filmed. It's like a broken egg to me now. There's no putting it back together. Every time I sit down to watch it, I want to see that second draft ending way more than the one that they actually went with.
That's I haven't read it. That's something I ought to check out.
It's well worth your time to check. I don't even know if it's still in print because it's got to be a good 20 years since I saw a copy of it. But sure. if you can find it, it's well worth getting because it's one of those rare scripts that's actually worth sitting down and reading. I mean, you laugh at it on the page. You wish they had filmed a lot of stuff from the second draft.
Who directed that one?
Jones and Gilliam split on
that.
Did
they? Okay. Because I thought just Gilliam directed Life of Brian. I don't.
Yeah,
I'm not a huge. I mean, I'm not a huge Monty Python fan, in so much as you know I can quote them all and all that stuff. But I do respect him. I like him a lot, and I just couldn't remember that. But I do know that it's just weird to me. It's weird to look at you know The Quest for the Holy Grail or Life of Brian or any of these things and expect the career that Terry Gilliam took out of it, isn't it?
Yeah. So,
but, I mean, and I really
like,
do.
This guy is also the guy who did Brazil.
Yeah, and I love Brazil. Okay, love Brazil. But, you know,
yeah.
I don't know, weird. Cool. That was your number what?
That was my number three.
Okay, so Christopher, what's your number three?
Number three. Okay, this may be, all right, if there are any surprises on my list, this may be it. And I had to go with the classic 1970s film Slapshot.
That's a great one. I love
and
that movie,
I'll tell you why I put this so high on the list.
Motherfucking
here.
Paul
okay, like I said, my original criteria was does it bring the funny, and then that got me down to 10. And then I had to think, well, okay, the top of my list should do something else. You know, it should bring a little something else to the table while it's bringing the funny. And like, you know, like, that's why Spinal Tap is where it is. I like what it has to say about the cultural force that is rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And Slapshot, while it's hysterically funny,
Ethan,
it's hysterically.
Have you seen this movie?
No.
Oh.
It's hysterically
don't you
funny.
Like Paul Newman?
I love Paul Newman.
Okay.
Oh. It's funny and it's not afraid to be funny in offbeat ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like when they're getting ready for the final championship game and the announcer is reading the introductions of the ringers that the opposing team has brought in.
Yeah.
And they all have like this really bizarre backstory that never gets mentioned again. Like there's one guy who's been living in seclusion in northern Quebec since the Denny Pratt tragedy. And you never hear another word about it. And you know, it's just, you know, I mean, every time I have to come up with a fake with a bio for like a gaming product, I'm always tempted to put in has been living in seclusion in northern Quebec since the Denny Pratt tragedy just to see if anybody gets it. So yeah, it's not afraid to be funny in its own way, but at the same time it's also a celebration of this bizarre thing that is professional hockey, and in a way sort of this larger need for, you know, this uniquely masculine thing of being together on a sports team, you know, beating each other senseless and bonding over that. I mean, in a way it's almost sort of like, you know, it's Fight Club the comedy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's based on real life experiences that the writer's older brothers who were in minor league hockey were telling her on the road. So there's a lot of truth to it. And it's a film, again, and to me, it represents the best of 70s cinema. It's not afraid to be what it is. The characters aren't always sympathetic. They don't always make good choices. They've got rough edges. They've got prejudices. They use bad language at a time when that was considered shocking.
Yeah.
But it's so real, and it's all the more funny for it. And I, you know, like I said, I don't know how many people would rank it over Spinal Tap or some of the other films we've talked about.
Sure.
But for me, I'm comfortable where it is.
Ethan, you should definitely see it. I mean, I've been... Honestly, I'm kind of ashamed of you for not seeing it because you claim to be a Paul Newman fan.
Sorry.
But hey.
There's several Paul Newman movies I haven't seen.
Well, you know, this is one of the important ones because it's so not a Paul. I mean, obviously it's a Paul Newman movie, but it's just not what you expect. Are we on to my number three already?
We are.
All right. My number three is a movie that I think I've talked a little bit about on the on past shows before that I like a lot, and it's one of those other ones that's making me out to be a goddamn liar, because this is another one that came out relatively recently, and certainly in my lifetime. It's 1999 Frank Oz film, Bowfinger. It's a movie that I like a lot. It's another one of those ones that speak...
It's my number seven.
It's so... wrong about how funny it is. I mean, there's just things.
It is one of those that if you are not as big of a movie geek,
exactly,
it's some of it is lost on you.
We're gonna get the best. You know, we're gonna get the best film crew money can buy. Andale, andale, andale. They're at the border, rushing border crossers into the back of the van.
And for me, Steve Martin is hit and miss, and that movie for me is a huge hit. I love it.
For the most part, I like almost everything Steve Martin does.
Sure.
And I also love Three Amigos.
When he's on, he's on.
I actually am kind of remiss. I didn't put Three Amigos on my list, but, you know, hey. This is a movie I do like. And for me, Eddie Murphy's hit and miss. And
I think this is
amongst his best comedic work ever. I really like the scene in it when Steve Martin confronts Heather Graham when he finds out that she slept with Kiff, and she says, "You know what, baby, it's over." What? Why? Because you slept with Kiff. She says, "What?" And she says, "So." And she says, "So," and he goes,
"Well, I haven't thought about it that way."
and they go about their business. Yeah. It's just such an absurd movie, and I always like talking about that movie. I cannot talk about that movie, not bring up Terrence Stamp as the leader of Mindhead, that weird cult, pretty much, that Eddie Murphy's character.
That was around the time when Terrence Stamp just suddenly came back.
Yeah, it was nice. It's one of those movies that I don't think a lot of people would like if they're not a big movie fan. To me, it just tickled me. It was really funny.
Okay.
It was really funny seeing like the illegal immigrants at the end of the movie getting phone calls from Spielberg and Coppola and stuff like that with their big movie deals.
Yeah.
It's one of those movies that isn't mean about itself.
No, it makes fun of Robert Downey Jr. Is in it too. He's the
holy
producer.
Shit! I completely forgot about that. Wow. It's a great movie, and I didn't think it got the recognition it deserved. I would have liked to have seen... that's the movie I thought that Eddie Murphy should have got
his... happens all the time, is the trailer for it was awful.
Yeah.
The trailer made it look like a totally different movie.
Yeah.
And then that's why I didn't see it in theaters. And then I saw it when it was
in the video store. I did see it in theaters, actually.
This is funny.
Did I turn you on to that one? Or
you might have, but I remember watching it at the video store.
And I remember watching it at the theater because of, you know what? I saw it at the theater because of Terrence Stamp, because that was when Episode One came out, and I saw Terrence Stamp was also in this movie, and I'm like, what the hell? I like Eddie Murphy and Steve Martin and et cetera, and I'm like, this movie's really freaking funny. I do like that movie a lot. I thought that Eddie Murphy should have got an Oscar nomination
for it. Who was
the
director? Was it Frank Oz?
It was Frank Oz.
Frank Oz
directed that one. Good movie. I highly recommend it to anybody that hasn't seen it. Have you seen this one, Christopher?
Oh, yeah.
Really funny. I
noticing a definite inside showbiz thing on your movies.
Well, which is weird because I'm not on the inside of showbiz. I live I'm a student in Kansas, but I don't know.
And for me, that movie had me in tears numerous times, but for me, the very end bit with the kung fu stuff at the end, it was damn hysterical. I mean, it's a wonderful capstone to that movie. And
what was the name of the movie? Chubby Rain?
Yes, Chubby Rain.
that was really funny. I just really...
That sounds like something Eddie Murphy would actually shoot these days, doesn't
it? Yeah, unfortunately.
Yes.
Yeah, but I did really like that movie, and I haven't seen it in a while. I should watch it again.
And it came out in 99.
1999, yeah. Yep. I saw it waiting in line for Episode 1, for Star Wars Episode 1. I had to do something while I had somebody else waiting, so I went and saw it, and I'm like, that's a goddamn funny movie. Mm-hmm. So,
well, yeah. and 99, it's due for a remake, right?
Yeah.
Why not?
No, it's due for a reboot.
Yeah,
a
reboot. We'll do it with Zach Galifianakis and Jamie Foxx, you know, done.
Zach Galifianakis and, yeah,
sure, why not? Top. No, you know, not Jamie Foxx, Tracy Morgan.
There we go.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
I think I would shoot myself.
Yeah. And
Jonah Hill in there, too.
Sure, why not? I like Jonah Hill. But, hey, that's my number three, so it brings us down to Ethan's number dose.
All right. I physically could not make this list without putting this movie on here. It's, again, from 1974. It is, in my opinion, the only good Mel Brooks
You're wrong.
Movie, and it's Young Frankenstein.
I love Young Frankenstein. Young Frankenstein is my number two as well. I do like Blazing Saddles.
God.
I do like Spaceballs.
Don't get me started on those. Young Frankenstein is by far, it's a smart,
it's its best.
Goddamned funny.
It's
movie.
His best movie. It's not the only good movie he's made.
See, all that aside, Young Frankenstein
hilarious.
Is absolutely a treat. And
Rachel has never seen it, and I'm trying to get a copy of it.
My dad showed it to one of his friends. It's just a weird thing. My dad had a friend over and showed it to him, and this friend of his didn't laugh once during this movie. And I asked him, "Was your friend dead?" Because God damn it, this movie is funny.
Is this man still your friend, Dad?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this movie's got, you know, Gene Wilder, who I believe also co-wrote the film. But also had Madeleine Kahn and...
Kenneth Mars.
Kenneth Mars, Marty Feldman, and of course...
Fucking Marty Feldman was so funny in that.
Yes, as Igor.
Igor.
And for the longest time, I thought it was Igor. Because I
Igor.
Saw this before I saw the Frankenstein, Bride
really?
Of Frankenstein and whatnot. And I think this movie is still so well done. With Peter Boyle as the monster. Mm. Putting on the Ritz. Come on.
Putting on the Ritz!
This movie is a great capstone to those movies. Yes, it's a comedy. Yes, it's entirely in the different direction of the horror of
it's
the classic
it's a,
horror.
This movie is a eulogy for the Universal horror movies.
It's a love letter to it. And a
eulogy.
It does a great job of emulating it, but not insulting it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is what a lot of the parodies do.
I thought
nowadays.
You liked it's the producers.
I like the new version. I didn't like the old one.
All right, there's something seriously wrong with you. You need to
Apparently
get your head
so.
Checked out. But I do love Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
I do love it.
I mean, Peter Boyle and, of course, Cloris Leachman.
Oh,
in it as well.
Yeah.
It's also one of the only parts I can ever stand Terry Garr in.
You have an opinion of Terry Garr? I don't particularly.
And Kenneth Mars.
Kenneth Mars is so great.
Tu's a Lumberyard.
Tu's a Lumberyard. Yep.
And my thing with Mel Brooks is he recycled a lot of his material.
Yeah.
And this movie sort of begun a lot of the good stuff with the moving hump. I mean, God, come on.
Yeah.
You know, hump? What hump?
Yeah, and they also did that in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves,
Men in Tights, yes.
With the moving mole on Richard, what's-his-face's...
Yes, yeah. And this movie is
Richard
just...
Lewis.
Young Frankenstein just so beautifully emulates the classic horror movies that the... because, I mean, it used the same sets, you know? I mean, they went back and used same sets, same stuff. And Gene Wilder, it's probably the second role of Gene Wilder that I think of past Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
And this movie just really has... I can sit back and watch this movie, and to my chagrin, to my detriment, I actually don't have a copy of this movie anymore.
Really?
I had one a long time. I had one for a while, and I had to get rid of it at one point for another. You know, got to pay rent. But
Blu-ray.
It's one that I
get the Blu-ray.
Yeah, I
you
really
get,
want to get the Blu-ray.
You can get the Blu-ray for under $10. And
yeah,
it's worth it for the special features.
Yes, and it is definitely one I want to get. And if anyone hasn't seen this movie, it is just an incredibly funny movie. Incredibly funny. So check it out. It's Young Frankenstein, my number two.
Excellent. It's my number two as well. And I think he hit all the important parts for me, but I just want to reiterate, I thought Marty Feldman was fucking hysterical that movie.
As Igor, he's great.
He was so funny in that movie.
And it's Frankenstein.
Frankenstein! Have you seen it, Christopher?
Oh, my goodness. Since I saw it in the theaters.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't.
Kind of old here.
Okay, cool.
Okay, we forgive you.
We do. Yeah. I'd love to see that one in the theater, but unfortunately, I haven't. What's your number two?
My number two, since we're in a Mel Brooks mood, is Blazing Saddles.
I love Blazing Saddles, and Ethan hates that movie, can't stand that movie.
I have tried watching that movie, I've seen it multiple times, and I just can't fucking stand it.
I showed it to Rachel not too long ago, and I think that movie is absolutely freaking hysterical. It does lose me in the end when they start running around in modern time. I think that's a bit silly. But other than that, I find it really funny.
The movie's got funny parts, but to me, Young Frankenstein blows it out of the damn water.
I'll tell you why I put Blazing Saddles where I did. Let me rise to the film's defense here.
Please do. I do like it.
Well, first of all, again, it passes the ultimate test. It brings the funny from start to finish for me. But
Hedy
now,
Lamar.
People who have been paying really close attention to this have realized that we went off on a big rant against lowbrow films. Mm. And I would not deny for a second that there's some incredibly lowbrow stuff in here.
Yeah.
But let me explain to you why I think this film gets away from it and why I think it deserves to be number two. As I said, to be this high on my list, you had to do something other than just bring the funny. And here's what I think Blazing Saddles does. I think this is the greatest takedown of racism and prejudice that has ever been committed to any media in any place, anytime, anywhere. And to me, you simply can't do a highbrow takedown of racism, at least not one that's going to work as well as showing the fundamental thing that's wrong with racism is that it's based in stupidity.
Yep.
If you're going to do a film about racism, stupidity is by far the best route to go. And this is the thing that kind of put it over the top for me. We were talking Supernatural films, we were talking High Plains Drifter.
Uh-huh.
This is in the top five films that could not possibly be made today.
Yep. Oh, yeah. You bring that up. Yeah.
You couldn't get close to making this. And
they almost didn't get it made when they made it.
Exactly. In the 70s when types of films like this flew. I mean, and if you look at the elements, you couldn't get away with the language. You couldn't get away with the fact that, if you're going to make a film, about racism these days, first of all, you have to be incredibly preachy.
Uh-huh.
You have to have
Spike Lee direct it.
Well, you could do Traffic, I suppose.
That was mostly a joke.
Oh, God. What am I?
Traffic.
No, you threw me off base there. Won the best Academy Award. Big, long, preachy Brad Pitt episodic film, anti-racism, despised every frame of it. Thank you. That's
Babel.
It.
Yeah, that didn't win an Academy Award.
Yeah, it was Best Picture. Yeah,
no,
Best Picture.
It did not win Best Picture.
It was not. Crash won that year.
Yeah, I'll bet you $1 billion right now it did not win Best Picture.
I would just thank you to prove me wrong on that, because the thought that it was nominated turned my stomach.
I thought Brad Pitt was good in it. I don't even know if it was nominated for Best Picture. I do think that What's-Her-Face was nominated for it, though.
But enough of this unspeakable film. Let me give my last good point on Blazing Saddles.
Okay. Yeah, it's 2006, right. So 2007. Okay. Best Picture 2007 was, I'm sorry, continue.
Okay, so you have the blatantly racist characters who are still manage to be utterly hilarious, but they're idiots. You have no sympathy. You have no sympathy for them because they're such racist idiot morons. Mm-hmm. But look at the people that have sympathy on the minorities. They're all self-serving, backbiting people. You know, it's a film that shows that, you know, when it comes to race relations, at least in the 1970s, we're going to pretend it's the Old West, there aren't really any angels, at least in this point, other than the minorities themselves. And even they are not portrayed in that typical Hollywood, possessed of wisdom and magical powers. They're just believable, relatable, funny people. Mm-hmm. And I think that to me, there's a subtle genius to that. And
2007, the Best Picture was Departed, Babel, Letters from Iwo Jima, Little Miss Sunshine, and The Queen were nominated. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, thank God Departed won. Okay. And to me, there's even a bit of a meta gag in there. Okay. the one time in the film they're actually playing off of black stereotypes, the scene between Bart and Lily von Stupp. You know, there's a meta gag. Yeah, there's sort of a meta gag in there that, you know, you come out of this film thinking, oh, my goodness, thank goodness I'm not a racist like those people. But if you're laughing at that scene, you know.
I was laughing at her voice.
Oh, my goodness.
I thought her voice was so funny in that movie.
And I hear the line that got cut there now that I've heard Brooks explain it.
Okay, explain this to me.
He was on the old Bob Costas Later Show and was talking about the first time he showed it to the studio, and he was writing down the cuts they wanted him to make, and he had about 5 minutes left counting the credits. But in the end, he was able to save everything except for one joke, and the one joke he lost was as they're fading to black, and she's saying it's twoo, it's twoo, it's twoo, it's twoo. In the original way it was shot, Bart goes, "You're sucking on my elbow."
Oh my lord, that's
horrible.
He had
to lose that.
Well, unfortunately, I kind of agree with that. Other than the fact of look at what this movie was, and
yeah,
I do. I really, really, really like that movie, and I do think that maybe my preference to Young Frankenstein comes from my growing up and being a horror movie fan and enjoying that stuff as much as I did as a kid. But I think it's a really funny movie. Cool. Are we down to our number ones?
I think we are down to our number one.
Ethan, bring on the funny. What's your number one?
Okay, my number one is, obviously, I think this movie is freaking hysterical.
Sure.
It is a movie that brought together a great cast, has a great story, is smart, it's funny. It's got John Cleese in it, so, I mean, you got to love John Cleese. It's the 1988 Charles Crichton movie, A Fish Called Wanda.
Really?
I always forget
how much you like that movie.
This movie, Kevin Kline won an Oscar for it, rightly so. He's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah,
in it.
He was so
brilliant.
Good in that movie.
Ensemble cast in this movie with Jamie Lee Curtis, Kevin Kline, John Cleese. It is absolutely hysterical. I am a firm believer that John Cleese should be immortalized as a comic genius. Up there with the likes of Charlie Chaplin, okay?
Yeah.
I think the man is just brilliantly funny, and this movie is just such evidence of that. It is damn hysterical with this great heist that goes on. And the characters that come sort of spiral out of that with this great ensemble that's in there. I love John Cleese in it playing this very straight character of this barrister who then eventually sort of succumbs to various things. And you have just absolutely wonderful scenes in this movie between him and Jamie Lee Curtis, him and probably my favorite scene in the whole movie is... him and Michael Palin. Michael Palin is the other one that's in that one, I believe.
Yep.
Michael Palin has just been quote unquote tortured by Kevin Kline. John Cleese is trying to get information out of him, and of course there's this great brilliant part in it is this sort of lack of this communication where there's this breakdown in
this
communication.
This wonderful breakdown in communication,
where
yeah.
Where he's trying to tell him that he's going to the airport, and it's this brilliant scene where they're going through all of this and in great British fashion with these great farce that the Brits can really do is where it builds to this huge climax and then just snaps in two.
Mm.
Where you have these guys just with time is running out and, you know, he has to hurry and he's trying to get this information out of Michael Palin's character, Ken.
And we get the title.
And you get the title, you know, Fish Called Wanda. And, you know, I absolutely adore and love this movie. It is just so brilliantly put together. It's got such a great cast. It's just one of those perfect gems to me. Of comedy that I can sit down and watch this anytime and just have a great laugh and put a smile on my face. And, you know, Christopher, you were talking about, you know, with the jerk, how it's like, yeah, I've you know, hit rock bottom and you're having a horrible, horrible, horrible day. I can still pop this movie in and smile. So that's why it reaches right out to me at my number one.
See, and I do like this movie, and I like this movie a lot. It didn't occur to me. I like it. I find it funny. I don't find it rip-roaringly, you know, knee-slappingly funny. But I do think that Kevin Klein gets a lot of shit for that Oscar, and I've never quite understood that.
Cause no,
I thought he was really, really good in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've seen this one, Christopher?
Oh, yeah, and I agree with you. Seriously, if you want to hate Kevin Klein, can we just not all agree we should hate him for Wild Wild West?
Sure, yeah. Why not?
All right, there you go.
There are other things that we can dog on Kevin Klein for.
Absolutely.
I found him very deserving of that Academy Award. I kind of, in a sense, get the criticism in that it's a oddball choice for an Oscar, but at the same time, it was just, you know, it stood out so much. And I agree with it, and I do find it's a really good movie, and yeah, it does kind of have that feeling of the remnants of Monty Python going on in it.
Oh yeah.
Well, so. I mean that all comes back to the fact that they're more interested in dividing the categories by genitalia than they are comedy and drama.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good. At this point, is it your number one? Yeah.
Yep.
Go ahead, Christopher. What's your number one?
All righty. Well. Okay, again, has to be hysterically funny, check. Has to bring a little something more to the table. And to me, no film fit that. I mean, this is the first list I've done for you guys where I started with number one.
Really?
Because this to me, no doubt, and it survived every challenger that I threw at it. And it would have to be Monty Python's The Life of Brian.
I love that movie.
Because, again, funny from start to finish. Mm-hmm. And this is what puts it over the top for me. And I hate to talk much about my background because it's usually irrelevant, but this is something I think may make me unique among the fans of this film. Okay, I've been a believing, practicing Anglican Catholic since 1995, and I know that means that if I fit the stereotype, I'm supposed to despise this film. No, I think this is the greatest film made about religion ever. Period. End of discussion.
Okay, it's definitely one of those you can point out saying, "See, Monty Python they're smart guys."
Yeah,
and this movie is really evidence of that, because it's a very smart movie.
And I understand why people feel that it's anti-religious, but it's a straight emotional reaction rather than an intellectual one, because the Pythons admitted that when they were considering doing a parody of The Life of Christ, mm-hmm. they, not the most faithful guys in the world, and I don't mean that as a criticism, just a fact,
sure.
you know, they realized that Christ's essential message is pretty unassailable.
Yeah.
So the film – and if you notice, Christ is never mocked in the film.
No.
The people
– Brian is.
The people who get singled out are the people who really, really deserve it. And that's the people that have distorted that wonderful message over the centuries.
Yeah, probably some of my favorite bit apart about this movie is that intelligence where it's not what Christ is saying. It's what people are interpreting. You know, it's like, they say, blessed are the cheesemakers.
Exactly.
That is a commentary right there on organized religion, you know?
And
exactly. And isn't it an amazing coincidence that most of the people that got bent out of this shape as mm-hmm. being anti-religious are the people that, in my humble opinion, are the guiltiest of distorting that beautiful message? Oh, I mean, I understand why they're upset about it, because they're ultimately the ones being mocked and deservedly so.
And I could totally understand how that the uber religious, you know, uptight religious people can get very been out of shape out of this movie, because it so blatantly throws in the face of this this concept of God and this concept of Jesus Christ.
Well, I would disagree with you a little bit there. I don't think it's necessarily the degree of commitment that you have to your faith. I think it's just more a sense that, you know, it has to be your interpretation of this of that message.
Mm.
You know, much more so than the message itself.
Oh, yeah.
Because I know plenty of devoted people who adore this movie as much as I do and see the same things in it I do.
And it's the people that sort of attack the delivery of the message that get to me on this movie, because it is if you sit back and cause this is a movie you can analyze, you know.
Oh yeah.
And it's a smart talk about smart comedy. You know, I love this movie. It's my favorite religious film out there. You know, biblical epic religious film is this one.
And I'll tell you, okay, funny from start to finish.
Oh, yeah.
Greatest film ever made about religion. I will throw another one on here into why I put this as number one. This is also a deconstruction of political movements. It's one of the most brilliant political films ever made. And it's one that time, historical events keep bringing me back to it. And I'll pull one right from today's headlines. The Occupy Blank movement.
Yes.
Whatever else you think of them, whether you agree with them or disagree with them, what they're essentially asking for is a pretty close variation to, well, we demanded the complete demolishing of the Roman state within 12 hours. What kind of progress are we making on that?
Splitters.
Exactly. Exactly.
And what have the Romans ever done for us?
Colin like Powell died.
Exactly. Now, I hope I don't get too much in trouble with my friends that are out currently occupying various destinations. But, I mean, and seriously, and if you want, throw the Tea Party in there as a comparison to that. If you want to be fair and balanced. Oh, God, did I actually say that? Okay. But there you go. I mean, any political movement, left, right, center, whatever, ultimately devolves into the Judean People's Front.
Yeah, and for me, this movie is it's funny to look at the history of this movie and see the reaction it got from people, and also it really reminded me when Dogma came out, the reaction Dogma got, Kevin Smith's Dogma movie, it got the same type of thing. It's like, okay, guys, you're totally missing the point here. And this movie, it's the same way. It's like you'd have people go, oh, it's terrible. It's making fun of all this stuff. And it's like, have you seen the movie? Well, no. Of course I haven't seen the movie.
Scratch that. Colin Powell did not die.
Okay, that's good to know.
Sorry. My sister sent me a text, told me that Colonel Potter died, but the first one auto-corrected to Colin Powell.
Nice.
Oh, my. That's quite an auto-correction. Yeah.
Damn you, auto-correct.
In terms of this movie and whatever, I mean, I don't want to – we're not getting into theological debate here. I'm opposite end of the – well, I'm not the opposite end of the spectrum of Chris. I just don't belong to any – or Christopher. I don't belong to any particular religion. And, you know, it's – I get it. I mean, I understand that all this religious stuff is in the movie. I just don't care. I just find it a funny movie. It might not add to the overall, you know, beast or ball of yarn that is The Life of Brian, but the thing that makes me laugh without fail every time I watch the movie is the exchange about crucifixion. Yes. That kills
me. Oh, yeah.
You know, what happens to them then? Well, then they're crucified. Pretty nasty, huh? It could be worse. You know. Like,
well, let me throw a question your way, if you don't mind.
Please.
Okay. Isn't one of the great things about this film is again they're throwing Christ's message out there as, you know, be nice to the poor, try not to be unnecessarily violent. You know, I think one of the things they may subtly hint at is that you don't really need to belong to an organized religion to say that's a pretty good way to live your life.
Yeah.
And if you watch the film, it's the people that claim to be religious that have made the greatest hash out of what is just a simple message, and a good one, I think.
Mm-hmm. And trust me, just because I don't follow an organized religion doesn't mean I go out and burn the poor and kill people and rape them.
This movie, to me, sort of highlights my feeling on religion, and it's not that I don't like religion, it's I don't like organized religion.
And for me, I just don't,
It's the interpretation of various things. You know, to me, it all boils down to me, it's the blessed are the cheesemakers bit.
Yeah.
You know, wonderful. Like, that just sort of encapsulates what that movie means to me right there. Is that this movie isn't about, it's like, this isn't a movie about Christ, it's a movie about the guy born next to him. Yeah. And how absolutely horrible his life is, and you know it's a great movie. That's just a fun thing.
Well, right there, that's the capsule history of religion. You start out with be nice to the poor and try not to be overly violent, and then in no time at all you're arguing about whether you should follow the shoe or the gourd.
Yes. No, we must cast off a shoe. We must collect shoes.
There's some great films on all of our lists going on here. It's pretty cool. I love The Life of Brian. It's been a while since I've seen it. I do know the first time I saw it, I would have been probably 18 or 19 once again. Like I said, I was, you know, a late bloomer when it came to Monty Python. I know that I was in my room watching it on my first DVD player. It's one of the first movies I ever rented because I heard good things about it. Mm-hmm. And I know that my sister came in, my eldest sister, Stephanie, came in the room.
And I have the Criterion DVD of this one, actually.
Do you? Uh-huh. I should borrow that or steal it or something.
Well, but I found it at a half-price bookstore for $4.98.
That's very good.
Sold.
And the Blu-ray has a great documentary on it about the making and the controversy about it.
Yeah. I think that's on the Criterion
about that
Blu-ray.
Too.
Well, I do know that
the Criterion DVD anyway.
Getting back to what I was saying, when my sister Stephanie came in, it was at the very end of the movie when she came in to, you know, talk to me, borrow something for, I don't know why the hell she came in, and for whatever she came in to talk to me, and it was at the end of the movie, and right when they go up on the cross and they start singing the Bright Side of Life, you know,
one of the most
and
famous scenes, right?
My sister is a softly spoken person, you know. I've grown up with her, and I've seen her laugh and stuff before, and I've seen her laugh hard before. I have never seen her laugh as hard as when that was going on in this movie, and she stood there and watched the rest of it and asked me if she could stay in my room and watch it again. And it was just I do really like this movie a lot. I'm not going to say that it's a bad movie. I'm not going to go there. I just, you know, personally prefer the Holy Grail, but at the same time, you know, I think we talked about it with, you know, the Coen Brothers movies. It's like choosing your favorite orgasm. I mean,
yeah.
when it comes down to talking about the Monty Python films. So very cool, very very cool. Bringing it down to my number one, I think this is gonna put our lists, and I'm gonna make this really interesting discussion just kind of go off and kind of flop, because you guys keep on saying stuff that I'm kind of earmarking for when I get down to my number one. You guys said that it's got to bring on the funny, and this movie does bring on the funny. It doesn't have me crying, but I watch the movie with like a permanent semi-glazed smile on my face. It's a movie that bring to the table, you know, brings a little bit more to the table than just being funny. Absolutely, in this case. Ethan was talking about how he is ashamed and remiss that he does not own a copy of Young Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie I am absolutely ashamed that I do not own a copy of. I've never owned a copy of this movie, and there's actually a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful Criterion Blu-ray special edition of this movie. It's the 1940 Charlie Chaplin film, The Great Dictator.
Mm-hmm.
I am in love with that movie. I'm enthralled with that movie. I don't care if other people like it, honestly. I wish they did. I wish that they would enjoy it as much as I do, because I don't watch it and roll on the ground laughing. I watch that movie and I'm enamored with Chaplin's intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enamored with the fact that this is the guy that, you know, he was the little tramp, but he wasn't the little tramp in this movie. And don't try to tell me the little barber, the Jewish barber was a little tramp, because he wasn't. There are certain similarities there. And, you know, he built this catalog of, you know, wonderful films, be it, you know, Modern Times, Gold Rush, etc., you know, off of that. And then he realized, and he ran the tally, he's like, I can't keep making modern films without sound, so I have to make a sound movie. And, you know, he chose that he wanted to pretty much say goodbye to the character with, you know, something that was important to him. And, you know, this movie came out in 1940. And, you know, you have to understand that this movie was made 1937-ish.
Yeah.
So, you know, this was, you know, in the height of, you know, Hitler taking power and stuff.
Yeah.
You've seen the movie, Christopher?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Yes.
And to those of you that haven't seen it, it's Charlie Chaplin, and he plays dual roles in it. He plays a Jewish barber, and he plays a parody of Adolf Hitler called Adenoid Hinkel. And it's a remarkable movie, because like I just said, it came out in 1940, and he was criticizing Adolf Hitler before it was popular to do so. People obviously, they weren't big fans of him, but you know, now, you know, Hitler's obviously is, you know, a horrible dude, and everyone,
yeah,
you know, he's the epitome of everything that
it's
you
an
shouldn't
interesting
be
movie to see in retrospect.
It's a really interesting movie to see in retrospect. Mm. And I think that it's like, when people talk important films of all time, they talk the Gone with the Winds and the Battleship Potemkins and Citizen Kanes and all this stuff, and I've never really heard The Great Dictator come up, and I wonder why. Because a lot of people credit this movie for making at least Western audiences really take a look at Hitler again and make him less popular. And it was some people think that, like, that shift in popularity of Adolf Hitler made it more acceptable to enter into the war when time came. But all that aside, all the political shit aside, I can't care about that because I'm not a political person. I find that aspect of it fascinating. I find it absolutely fascinating. This is a movie I saw in the theater. When was that in the theater, Ethan? A couple months, 2, 3, 4 months ago.
Yeah.
And it was one of the single greatest experiences of my life seeing this movie in the theater because I love this film. And I watched it and I didn't hear a laugh in the audience, but it was weird. Is one of the main criticisms that people have about this movie is the movie moves along in a very similar fashion of what happened with Hitler in Germany, rather at the time of 1937, 1940, to where, you know, he was, you know, slowly gaining power. But you had the Jewish barber that got caught up in a resistance army, and he ends up swapping places with Hinkel, the dictator, and he goes out and gives an impassioned plea to be, you know, a decent person instead of it's a wonderful speech. I wish I could. I'm not Charlie Chaplin. I've never claimed to be Charlie Chaplin. I never claimed to be a good speaker. But it's a moving speech. And the main criticism that people have for this movie is the movie just dies at that point, and it becomes Charlie Chaplin's a message. You know, and at the time it was an unpopular political message coming from, you know, motherfucking Charlie Chaplin. Who the hell cares what Charlie Chaplin has to say? He's got $1 million, so what could he possibly, you know what it's like? And yeah, you know,
point. The feeling at the time was this isolationist view.
And, yeah, so. And that's the whole fucking
people didn't
point.
Want to hear that.
But, you know, Charlie Chaplin, unfortunately, you know, he died on Christmas Day 1977. And luckily, since he's died, people look on him a lot more positively than they used to.
Yeah.
People used to hate Chaplin. They always said he's a genius, you know, but they attacked him for his multiple marriages to, you know, younger women. They like to say that, you know, he wasn't an American. He was born in England, never claimed otherwise.
Right.
But they like to say that he took advantage of America, and, you know, he criticized where he shouldn't, and they didn't think that he had any right to be making this movie like The Great Dictator. And I just find it to be, first off, I love watching anything Charlie Chaplin makes. I don't care what it is. I will watch it. And I just like watching the physicality of the man. I mean, it's just amazing, like, how much that, you know, he can be funny with sharpening a razor blade on a bootstrap leather, or just like something in a walk, or that wonderful scene when he's ass Hinkle, when he's playing with the globe and he has the dance and he's bouncing it up in the air, and then at the end of it he pops and he falls down all dramatically and starts crying. And I love this movie, and I'm actually right now thinking about how pissed off I am that I don't own the Criterion. Mm-hmm. And I love this movie, and I cannot stress enough to people that they need to see it. So, you guys have anything to add?
It's been a very long time since I've seen the movie, and so it really, I don't really have anything to add to that. It's a great film. Not just a comedy, but, you know,
it's just a great film.
Yeah,
it's a great comedy, but I think I wonder why it isn't more applauded in terms of important cinema. I mean, maybe I don't understand it as well as I like to think I do, but I do find it an incredibly important film, like, in just in terms of the history of cinema. Now, you have seen it, Christopher.
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay. Do you like it? Do you not like it? Do you not really care one way or the other?
Well, I have a very complicated relationship with it.
Okay.
Because I admire the artistry that's there.
Mm-hmm.
And normally, if I watch a film, the first thing I do is try to discard politics of everybody involved. I'm not always successful there.
Sure.
But I learned very quickly that celebrity politics is the realm of pure idiocy. You know, I mean, there's a number of celebrities I think that have anything resembling a valid political view is very, very, very tiny, and most of them are dead. But here, you're right that, okay, he's making an explicitly political film. He went there first. So I have to look at the politics for it. And I think you're absolutely right to salute him for denouncing Hitler at a time when it wasn't exactly popular to do so. And he deserves every credit in the book for that. And I certainly don't want my message to be misconstrued. I'm second to none in hating Hitler. If Hitler were right here now, I'd kick him in his one testicle. And that would just be a start. Okay. So, but here's the thing. Okay. All right, Chaplin's going to inject politics with it.
Okay.
He's another one of these people who hates Hitler. Good for you. not alone on that. But during his life, not such a big problem with Stalin. And I just have I just have a trouble accepting a political message from somebody.
Have you read his autobiography?
No.
He states that one of his biggest he has two huge regrets in his life, specifically related to the Great Dictator. One of them is he wished he never made the movie, because when he made the movie, he was not aware of the atrocities being done against the Jewish people. He knew that they were being mistreated and treated as second class citizens. He said he had no idea that they were that they were being rounded up and murdered by the millions and stuff. And he said that had he known that, he would not have made the movie. The second thing that he regrets about it is he ended up leaving Stalin out of this mix, and he said that he considered the guy that was making fun of Jackie Oakey's character, the guy that's making fun of Mussolini. I can't remember the character. He almost made him a parody of Stalin, but he didn't do it because he had an idea for a movie that he wanted to make to criticize Stalin, and he did not think that Hitler and Stalin were the same level of nastiness, and that idea of that movie ended up turning into Monsieur Verdot, but he did not make that movie to be a direct criticism of Mussolini, because at that point everything that happened with the Jewish peoples in World War II came out, and he was carrying around that guilt for making this movie making light of a situation, and so he did not want to make another movie that made fun of a horrible situation. I'm sorry, but do continue.
Yeah, well, I had read something somewhere that he had some regrets in that regard, and like you stated it much better than I could. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I did not mean to do that.
No. Seriously, I'm serious. You made my point far better than I could. But just knowing that he's aware of it, it's hard to acknowledge it as a missed opportunity. And I guess just where I am artistically right now, I'm developing a much greater love for an artist like, say, Rod Serling.
Yeah,
who would nail absolutely Nazism and communism, and unapologetically would tell people it's the same thing. People, the differences between them aren't worth mentioning.
Yeah,
okay? it just seems like a lost opportunity there. And again, it would be easier to overlook if it weren't meant to be an explicitly political work.
Well, my thing about it is I cannot say it's not an explicitly political work. I will lose that argument so fucking fast it wouldn't be fun. But my thing about it is, and I don't I've read the autobiography, actually. It's out of print now, and I can't find it anywhere, and the copy I had fell apart, and it's been a long time since I read it. But he talked about when he decided to make the film, and they touch on it a little bit in Chaplin. Excuse me, the Richard Attenborough film.
Yeah,
about how he knew that when he made this movie that it was going to be the end of the Little Tramp. But when he kills the Little Tramp, he wants it to be talking about something. Important to him. So, you're right, it is a very overtly political film. He is doing a message, but he's doing it because, while, yeah, obviously the Little Tramp was his bread and butter, it was a household name, it made him, just tons of money. He had so much love for that character, and it broke his heart that he wasn't able to continue with it. And I can't criticize him too much, because he was in effect killing this thing that he loved so much, and he wanted to do it with something that meant a lot to him. And, granted, this is Charlie Chaplin. He answered to nobody at this time. I mean, he was a world star at this point. He owned his studio. He produced the movie. He directed the movie. He starred in the movie. He scored the movie. He wrote the movie. And I can't feel too sorry for him, but at the same time, I don't feel like I'm in a position to say, well, shame on you for making this movie that's attacking Hitler, but you're not attacking Mussolini, or you're not attacking Cleopatra, or whatever. I mean, to me, it was what he was doing, and it was something that he was doing as a statement, saying that this is what is killing this thing that means so much to him. I mean, I don't know, man. I just
I have a lot. I have so much respect for Charlie Chaplin, but I also put myself in a position to where I always have to defend him because a lot of people don't like him. Mm-hmm. Either people are in the school of thought where you're coming from, where he's a pampered, spoiled little rich boy that has no right to talk politics, or there's the people that like to call him un-American, or there's the people that like to call him pedophile, or the people that like to say that he was a deadbeat because he didn't want to pay for the child that wasn't his.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I really like Chaplin. Mm. And I love The Great Dictator. It's amongst my favorite of his films. Mm. And this really turned into a tangent, and I really apologize.
Yeah,
it's all good.
Well, hey, you want to hear another tangent?
Sure.
Yeah, this thing about the British chaplain being called un-American reminds me of this great Roger Ebert story.
Okay.
Ebert has told some great stories about his time writing scripts with Russ Meyer.
Yeah.
And he's talking about their experience making the abortive Sex Pistols film, Who Killed Bambi?
Yep.
And he was talking about how Russ, who was a proud World War II veteran, really immediately did not hit it off with the extremely iconoclastic John Lydon.
Yeah.
And he said that when Russ finally snapped and yelled at Lydon, he yelled at Lydon, "Oh, yeah, well, we Americans came over and saved you guys during the Battle of Britain." And Ebert thought it was doubly hilarious because, Lydon is Irish.
Yeah.
And they were neutral. And so and America was neutral during the Battle of Britain. We were still saying, hey, good luck.
Yeah, have fun with that.
So it was just such a – I mean, for a guy that was actually involved in it, it was just such a completely off the target, attempt at starting a fight.
Yeah.
And I just, it kind of reminded me of that.
I guess since I'm going to go off on another little tangent here, you bring up Roger Ebert, and Roger Ebert at one point, early in his career, he had an opportunity to, he got to meet Chaplin one time at a restaurant, and he was at a restaurant with somebody at the time, and I don't remember who it was, and he looked over, and, this is all in, written form. And he looked over and he saw Charlie Chaplin. And in his mind, he said, oh, look, there's Charlie Chaplin. And he said that, this was not the little tramp that he saw. This was not the guy that he saw in all the scum. He looked, he looked really sad and he looked really depressed. And then, real life Roger Ebert just said, "Hey, everybody, look, it's Charlie Chaplin." And at that point, as soon as he said that, Charlie Chaplin turned on. And then, the little tramp showed up. And it was he was not a happy person, but yeah. He was a very public person, and he was never somebody to, go out and be a grump in public. And, I've always respected the guy, and, as a fan of film, I can never overlook or underappreciate his impact that he's had on film. And it sucks that I never lived in the same time as him, because he'd be somebody that, if he was alive today, I'd be writing him letters and begging for an autograph and stuff like that. I was at a hotel in – where was that? Connecticut. I was in a hotel in Connecticut, and in that hotel they had a gift shop that was full of autographs, and they had an autographed derby, bowler derby from Chaplin that I almost bought, but – I couldn't spend $700 on a hat with some ink on it. But
no, and you never know if this is the guy who's selling it to you.
Well, it came with a certificate of authenticity and blah, 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 but it was so cool. And, autograph seeking doesn't mean anything to me if I don't actually get it from the person themselves.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm totally with you there.
Well, obviously, we do feel very passionate about all these films, because we can go on talking about them for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
So, why don't we wrap this up so Christopher can hopefully go back to not being able to sleep, and Ethan can get home, and I can hopefully get some sleep. And why don't we just run down our top 10 films from our comedy genre and wrap this up.
All right. Well, my number 10 was the 2005 The Producers.
See, didn't do it for me.
See, that movie had me in tears.
I like the original.
My number 9 is The Princess Bride.
I just don't think that is a comedy. I mean, it is funny, though.
Number 8 is A Night in Casablanca.
Really? Not Duck Soup?
Wow.
Not Duck Soup. No, huh. I really liked A Night in Casablanca.
I do, too, but I love Duck Soup.
Duck Soup's great, but Night in Casablanca, for some reason, I just love that movie.
That's a great movie.
Wow.
What's wrong?
I'm just, I'm not, I'm, please don't think I'm hating on your choice, but I'm just, that over A Day at the Races or A Night at the Opera, that's such an unconventional choice.
I know. I'm weird that way. My number 7 is Bowfinger. Number 6, Without a Clue. Number 5, Tropic Thunder. Number 4, Hot Fuzz. Number 3, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Number 2, Young Frankenstein. And number 1, A Fish Called Wanda.
Cool. Christopher, what's your list?
Well, 10 was my out-of-nowhere choice. It's the 1989 mockumentary, The Making of And God Spoke, which is, if you have not seen it, well worth tracking down.
It's funny.
Especially in modern times, because in an era where half the country is convinced that Hollywood is made up of communists, even the puppets, and that they're completely hostile to religion, it does a wonderful job of showing that, you know, you're mistaking malice for just pure laziness. And it managed to be a very, very, very funny film on top of it. And the guy who plays God in that, R.C. Bates, is a Facebook friend of mine and one of the nicest people I've ever met. So,
I have to
speak up for my buddy R.C. Bates. Okay. And number 9, I did Office Space. 8 was the original Naked Gun.
Right.
Number 7, Bad Santa. Yeah, I should have said that for our holiday theme show, right?
Sure, why not?
But anyway, okay, our greatest Christmas movies. That would probably top my list, strangely enough. But anyway, okay, 6, Airplane, then we could do The Jerk, Spinal Tap, Slapshot, Blazing Saddles, and Life of Brian.
Cool. My number 10 is a movie that I just put on here because I always use my number 10 as a throwaway. So the one I'm throwing away is the 2011 The Muppets, because I just love the shit out of that movie. Probably a lot more than it deserved. My number 9 is the, I believe it's also a Frank, yeah, it is a Frank Oz movie, The Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Then my number 8 is another Charlie Chaplin film. It's Modern Times, and I still don't know how the hell they did the roller skating scene, and I'd like to find that out before I die.
Yeah.
I have no idea how they accomplished that in 1936, but you know. Hey. See, my number 7 would be Monty Python and the Quest for the Holy Grail. Let me get to my list let's see. Tropic Thunder was my 6, Airplane is my 5, Clerks was my 4. Young Frankenstein was my 3. Bowfinger was my 2. Bowfinger was my 2. My favorite was The Great Dictator, and I think I need to go find a video store open right now and fix my not owning that Criterion now. But yeah, that's been our comedy, and I'm actually pleased with how this show turned out. I think I'll have to hear it through, but I think I've enjoyed the conversation. But stay tuned. We're going to be right back with our outro section. And we are back, and that was our discussion about comedy films, and as I expected, we had 3 incredibly different lists, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed talking about it. I finally got to say my piece on The Great Dictator. Maybe I could finally shut up about it, but I doubt it. I do have that diarrhea of the mouth.
You do.
Yeah.
But it's okay.
It's okay. But thank you once again, Christopher, because you're quickly becoming one of my favorite guest hosts that we have on the show, because we always get good stuff out of you.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
You on here.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Yep. I still don't know what we're going to do next week. I don't feel like editing this out, so I'm not going to say who's on. So just tune in next week to find out who is on. Do you have anything to add, Ethan?
No.
Christopher?
Oh, just thank you guys for having me on again. It's like I said, always an honor and a pleasure. And thank you all y'all that listened.
Well, thank you.
Do you have anything that needs to be plugged, by the way?
Nothing I can talk about right now.
Alrighty.
Well, I guess that's going to bring it into our comedy show. So, until next time, I'm Aaron.
I'm Ethan.
Let your geek flag fly.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. For life. word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show, keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life. Come on, Brian, cheer up. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Worst things happen to see, you know. Always look on the bright side of life. What you got to lose? You know, you come from nothing, you're going back to nothing. What you lost? Always nothing.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Nothing will come from nothing, you know. Records available in the foyer. Some of us got to live as well, you know. All right, it's a lot. Let's get this place up there. He chose his mantle within 3 weeks. What do you think pays for this, brother? You've got to make the money back, you know. I told him. I said to him, Bernie, I said, they'll never make that money back.